Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600. And thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks.
Hey, good morning, everybody. So I was kind of given a tip out of Chelsea Piers in Stamford a couple weeks ago. My understanding was that Chelsea Piers has three swimmers that were trained in their 9 short years that are in Beijing, or they were in Beijing at the time, prepping to compete for the Olympics. 26 female swimmers, three of them who trained at Chelsea Piers in the facility, again, that has been barely open a decade. And one of the coaches is actually here this morning. I am so excited to have the opportunity to talk this morning to Jamie Barone, who is here and actually has past experience with the Olympics as well. Jamie, welcome to the show. Thank you for being here. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
So first and foremost, let's talk about you, Jamie, your experience, your background with swimming, and then what kind of brought you to Connecticut.
Sure. So just a quick point of clarification. While I wish I was a two-time Olympian, I went to Olympic trials twice and have subsequently sent some swimmers to the Olympics, but unfortunately myself never competed. I actually grew up in Connecticut, about a mile from where Chelsea Piers is, and I was coaching down in Baltimore at a swim club down there and got a phone call from an acquaintance who said, hey, these guys are building a pool in Stamford. And, you know, are looking for somebody to come in and help build the programming out of it, and got connected with the owners of Chelsea Piers, and we hit it off and moved back home happily and started the program there in 2012.
So apologies on the clarification. I think I've barely made it out of I think I've barely made it out of my parents' pool. So even the Olympic trials are very impressive to me.
I didn't want anybody to think I was taking credit for making the Olympic team when I obviously hadn't. So I just wanted to make sure that was clear.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you so much. And when did you do the Olympic trials?
I went in 2004 and then again in 2008.
Wow. What was that like?
The most pressure-packed environment you've ever seen in your life, and honestly, I wouldn't wish it on anybody.
Yeah.
It was really gut-wrenching. I mean, you know, for there's 26, well, in most cases, 26 men and 26 women who make the team. This year, only 23 men made it. And for every 23 smiling faces you see, there are countless people at the cool-down pool sobbing in their goggles quietly, knowing that, you know, they just put in years and years and years and years of hard work only to come up short. It's the Olympic Games is far less stressful from what I've heard from everybody who's qualified.
Really?
That's a much easier environment. Oh, yeah. I mean, if you're an American and you make the Olympics, the standards are so high to make the U.S. Olympic team, the chances are when you get to the Olympic Games, you're going to be, you know, a contender, just because if you can make it here, you're going to be better than most people.
Wow.
So when you get there, that's the fun part. The trials is the real pressure cooker that everybody's got to deal with.
Yeah. I mean, and Jamie Barone is here, and I'm really just, it's so neat to get this kind of perspective. I mean, you talk about training, and we hear about this even from whether it's the Olympic trials, Olympic athletes, people who had formerly competed. You know, how long have you trained? How long have you been a swimmer, a competitive swimmer?
Well, it's funny. I actually just got back in the water about 3 weeks ago for the first time since 2008. I have not taken a stroke.
Really?
I was done. I mean, after all those years of, you know, two a days, I was in the water over 20 hours a week. You know, between dry land, we were swimming 7 days a week. Between dry land and swimming, it was like 24 hours of training. And after, you know, years and years of that. And I mean, listen, hopefully you're only doing that when you get to the tippy top. I don't think that's a healthy thing to do for teenagers, but you know, I was in my 20s and fully committed to the lifestyle of trying to be an elite athlete.
Mm-hmm.
And after years of that, you're just like, okay, I've had enough. I think I'm going to pursue other fitness goals. But I'm doing a charity race for Swim Across America, August 8th. And I have to swim a mile and a half. And having just gotten back in the water, I forgot how hard swimming was. My God, I'm swimming like, you know, a fifth of what I used to. And it's grueling.
Wow.
It's a very, very challenging sport. Yeah.
Oh, it totally is. I think swimming is one of the most, like, it gives me anxiety. I love watching it, but I just am nervous the entire time. I don't know how you guys even do it. I have no idea. I would just be the worst. I would just sink to the bottom. I'd be like, I'm done. I can't do
wish,
it.
I wish they could put, like, an average Joe in the water next to the Olympians, just so you could get some context for how fast they're actually going. Because, like, when you're watching Olympians race Olympians, you know, everybody's fast, so it doesn't really look like anybody's that fast. But if you put them in the pool with, you know, virtually any other person on the planet, you'd go, oh my God, how are they doing this and not getting tired? It's really kind of remarkable.
Yeah, no, for sure. And again, for anyone who's just tuning in, we're so excited we have Jamie Barone on. He is one of the Chelsea Piers Aquatics swim coaches, and he himself actually swam in the Olympic trials back in 2004 and 2008. And Jamie, correct me if I'm wrong, because I could be, but did you also train with Michael Phelps?
Yeah, so when I was in Baltimore, I started swimming with him back in 2001. So he was relatively unknown outside of the swimming world. So I had a very interesting front row seat to watch him develop from a 15-year-old, you know, kind of awkward, gangly kid into, you know, what we know him as now, which was a really very interesting perspective to have on that whole thing. It was a wild ride, to say the least.
I mean, was his wingspan still that large at 15 years old?
Oh yeah, I don't think he grew like physiologically grew much after 15.
Really?
He certainly grew as a human being, as we all saw. Yeah, he was already pretty big, even as a kid. He's got a lot of physical attributes that made him great, but his mental game is just second to none. I mean, the amount of pressure he dealt with from the run up to 2004, from like mid 2003 through Athens, and then, you know, basically for another 4 years leading into Beijing would have crippled most people. You know, with the eyes of the world on him every time a big meet came up, and he just he has ice water in his veins. It's pretty remarkable.
We wanted to talk a little bit about the training, because Chelsea Piers barely has been around for a decade and is doing remarkable stuff. Jamie, could you talk a little bit about the program?
Yeah, absolutely. We're really proud. The facility itself has had three swimmers come through. One, actually, Kieran Smith, who just won a medal, I think, this morning in Japan, last night in the U.S. He swims for another team in Connecticut, but the pool is exquisite, and they would come in and rent space. So I'm good friends with his coach, and we're very happy for him. But Chelsea Piers, our team itself, has had two swimmers come through, both of whom actually just swam about 20 minutes ago. We had a young lady named Alex Walsh who swam with us when we first opened until her family moved a couple years later. And then a young woman named Kate Douglas, who joined us in 2016 and swam with us until she left for University of Virginia. And Kate is the top seed after prelims in her event, the 200 IM. And I think Alex is tied for third going into the semifinal, which will be tonight, local time. So the training, we took a very progressive approach to the way we were training the athletes, in that I know when we spoke before, I was saying that I was in the water, you know, 20 hours a week plus dry land. So the training was like, you know, over 24 hours a week most weeks. But I said I was an adult and, you know, had fully bought into that idea. At Chelsea Piers, when we designed the program, we wanted to make sure that the kids weren't completely overwhelmed with the training. So I came up with this idea that maybe running two-a-days for kids in high school is not the best idea. And when I say a two-a-day, I mean like get up and practice in the morning before school and then go to school and then come back and practice after.
Sure.
So it was a tough sell at first, because a lot of people were like, well, this is the way everybody else does it. Why aren't you doing it the same way? And what I try to explain to people is that at this age, sleep is really important for these kids, particularly when they're waking up. You know, if a kid comes home from practice in the afternoon and they're up until 11:30 doing homework, having them wake up 5 hours later, I think is counterproductive. I think they're going to get physically beaten down. They're going to get mentally beaten down. Their bodies are not properly recovering. So we kind of peeled back the amount of swimming they were doing and found great success with it. Kate left us the number one recruit in the country. And we've had, four or five kids go on to very high level scholarships at Division I schools. We've sent like 40 kids over the last 9 years to swim in college at various levels. We've had a number of Olympic trials qualifiers. And even though Kate wasn't with us when she made the Olympic team, we felt like our job was to set these kids up to swim really well after they left our program. And that philosophy seems to be bearing fruit now. So we're really happy.
That's incredible. And I do think, that's a huge aspect, not only for their own physical growth and for them being great athletes, but also, like you said, motivation for them to want to keep staying with this and not getting burnt out. I'm curious, Jamie, do you think other facilities will follow that mindset? Do you think, two-a-days might be something eventually maybe not for everyone, but something of the past to go more towards the way that you're doing things? I mean, you're seeing great success in a very short amount of time.
It's really hard to get away from the dogma of what's been done by your predecessors, who have all had enormous amounts of success. And I mean, look, I'm pretty confident that if we had done more with the athletes while they were in our venue, they probably would have ended up faster, which would have made us look even better. But I think it all comes down to what you think is best for your swimmers. And I mean, if you ask 10 coaches what their philosophy is, you'll get 10 different answers,
right?
Even if all 10 of those coaches are really successful. So I think having some variation in the market is really good because it lets the consumer choose what they think is best for them. And, there's something to be said for running double practices for distance swimmers, particularly females, who tend to benefit from a little bit more volume of work. Than, say, sprinting males who don't need quite the same volume.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not in any way disparaging it or saying it's the wrong thing to do. I'm just saying this is what we found worked really well for us. Some teams might adopt that. Some teams might start to cycle the mornings in for, 6 or 8 weeks and then cycle them out and give the kids a chance to recover. I mean, there are infinite permutations out there, and yeah. I think – it's fun to experiment with different ways of doing things.
And I'm just curious, Jamie, before I let you go, how young do you guys start training people?
It's as soon as they can swim all four competitive strokes pretty close to legal, meaning if they were entered in a race, they wouldn't get disqualified. That's when we think they can do a competitive swim team. But, we strongly advocate that anyone under the age of, say, 13 or 14 is playing multiple sports. They're not just swimming. And making sure that the training frequency and duration is appropriate for the age. So, like, we wouldn't want a 7-year-old swimming 5 times a week for 90 minutes. That's outrageous.
Mm-hmm.
They should be sampling sports at that age. So, like, a couple times a week for 45 minutes so that they see what swimming is like and then have the opportunity to go out and play soccer or baseball or hockey or any of the other sports that will help them develop as an athlete, not just swim. So that by the time they're 12, they're completely unbalanced in their development. They've got, creaky shoulders and bad knees. We want them to do as many things as possible. And at Chelsea Piers, the great part is you can do all of those things at Chelsea Piers. So you get coaches of other sports that share a similar philosophy to me, which is that, multilateral development is the key to long-term success. And you can go from soccer practice and then run down to the pool and jump in and swim, or go from hockey practice and come across the hall, literally across the hall, and come over to swim practice.
That's so cool. That's such a great opportunity.
Yeah, I wish it was here when I was growing up. I wonder how my life would have been different. But wonderful opportunity for anybody in the area, and I highly recommend if you're looking for healthy, supportive environment for your kids to come and do sports, Chelsea Piers is by far the best place. And the facilities are insane as well. So you got that too.
Well, Jamie Barone, we so appreciate all the work that you've done with the aquatics program. And we thank you so much for your extra time this morning. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Have a good day, Melissa.
Thanks. You too, Jamie. We're with our marriage consultant, Bob Donovan, this morning. Is it okay to have a friendship with someone of the opposite gender if you're married? Now, I know, Bob, if you were to ask high school Melissa this, I would say it's fine, it's whatever. But this is a great question when it gets to your marriage. Why'd you think of this topic?
Actually, I was sharing this with just somebody I know at church, and he said, hey, I got a great idea. What about friendships of people of the opposite gender?
Mm.
And I kind of just passed it off. But as I came back and I started looking at it, it's a great topic. There's a lot of social scientists that feel that we should. It's healthy and it's good. And there's a voice that says it's not. So that's what makes a good topic. And I felt this was a great topic.
I think so, too. So let's weigh both options out. Let's start with the yes. It is healthy to have friendships in your marriage that are of the opposite gender. Why the yes? Why is it good?
Yeah. Well, so really funny, but on Tuesday, the 20th of July, CNN published an article about, it's called Hitched, and it says that limiting friendships of the opposite sex once you're married doesn't allow different perspectives that you gain from the opposite sex. So their position was that it's okay. So I thought that was really timely. I dug a little deeper and look at, again, some really prominent therapists, social scientists. You know, their other views are, some said to avoid friendships of someone with the opposite gender is like choosing to befriend somebody because of their age. That's not fair.
Yeah.
You know, somebody else says,
like, you and I are like friends, this. But we're only
exactly.
a couple years apart.
Exactly.
More than a couple, my friend.
So, somebody else said basically that friends should be based on what, character, personality, not their marital status. You know, mm-hmm. A friend is a friend. Are they loyal? Are they trustworthy? Are they caring? So, you know, it's almost not fair to that, you know, their gender shouldn't determine your friendship. Right. Here's a question for you.
Mm-hmm.
Right. What if you have a long term healthy friendship with somebody of the opposite gender? Right. And you're mm-hmm. married. And what should you do? Like if you listen to like what should you do? Should you just stop having friends? So that's another argument that I'm not going to just drop a friend of 15 years.
Yeah, so. I mean, that's the thing, Bob. My two best friends in this world, they're both from my high school days. They went to prep. I went to Laurelton. And we remained friends all through college and even after college. But the thing that we did was I very much integrated Derek at a very early stage, letting them know this is the person I'm pursuing. Hey, this is the person I'm in love with. Hey, this is the person I'm going to be marrying. And they kind of almost like adopted Derek into their crew, if that makes sense. I made Derek a part of it. And, you know, and maybe people don't feel they need to do that. I do think that's a good, healthy alternative, though, if you are in this predicament, not excluding your spouse. I think that doesn't mm-hmm. feel good.
Yeah. So great example, right? And to be honest with you, in all transparency, I have a really close friend that I worked with at Pfizer in New York City. She still remains to this day a very close friend. So, you know, I have one, and Karen knows her, and we've been invited. Her husband's a rabbi. We've been invited to their son's bar mitzvah. So, okay, I've made that work.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a really good argument for people that can make this work. A friend is a friend, right?
Yeah.
So if you listen to this side, this voice, you can make that argument.
But what about the other side? We're talking to Bob Donovan, our marriage consultant. What about the no's? Why would experts say it's not a good idea?
So one thing that there is research behind this. So a lot of what I just mentioned, a lot of this was anecdotal. There is research behind this in an article by the Journal of Social Psychology and Personality, basically said 60% of romantic relationships start as friends. And that was kind of a recent article. The one that I found out about that I found fascinating was another one by Dr. Harris, Kurtzel, and Mansour, basically said very specifically that 64% of men and 44% of women reported that opposite gender friends become sexual partners.
Oh, wow.
So there's more, which I'm not going to get into. But if you look at those two studies, again, there's evidence and research that it does lead to infidelity, right? Mm. I'll give you one more. I'll give you one more from the incredible actor Billy Crystal, right? Did you ever see When Harry Met Sally?
Oh, of course. Sure, sure.
Right? Yeah, right. Great movie, right? So Billy Crystal in that movie says male and female friendships simply do not work because sex always gets in the way. So that was kind of funny. But wow. There's more. Emory University came out and said there's decades of research that show here's the key right here, that if not handled properly, opposite gender relationship can pose a real threat to your marriage, that couples need to proceed with caution. Sadly, they don't, and there's devastating consequences.
Sure.
So, and there's more. I'll end with this, and you and I can talk a little bit. But so even like you just described something that worked, okay? I have something that does work. Mm-hmm. Can it work? Yes. So usually there's healthy boundaries. You just described a couple. I can give you more. We maybe get into that next time. But here's the thing. So when you do have somebody that's a good friend from the opposite gender, mm-hmm. what happens when you and your husband, you and your spouse, me and my wife, go through a rough season, which we all do? You go through times where you're a little disconnected.
Sure.
That there's a right. You do that. Mm-hmm. So when that happens, who's available that's safe, trustworthy, and there? Your friend.
That's a tricky one. Yeah, that's where it could get complicated because, first of all, when you're going through any marital stuff, to me, I would always seek professional help. I would never go to someone else because people are flawed. You don't want people to cast judgment on your spouse, on your marriage,
right.
on you.
Right.
Like, you're in a very vulnerable place. So I would never really suggest a friend ever, whether it's the same sex or not.
That's me.
Right.
Yep.
That's what
that's
I would
you.
Do.
You know that, Melissa, when you go through a tough time, it's rough. You're not thinking clearly. You're emotional. And again, and all the point of this person basically says, when you're in a vulnerable position with your spouse, who is there waiting with a good, safe, listening ear?
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
And that's kind of the point.
No, it's a really great question. And I'm so glad that we are not done with this topic. We're going to dive into part two the next time Bob is on. And we're going to answer the question, what does a spouse do? Bob, I love this topic. Thank you so much for bringing it to our attention.
Sounds great, Melissa. Always glad to talk about something like this with you.
Lieutenant Jim Perez, Fairfield Police Department. Crime on the mind. Melissa in the morning. WICC 600.
Good morning, Lieutenant Perez. I noticed this morning there was an alert out by our First Select Woman as well as Fairfield Police talking about clarifying misinformation on social media. It kind of prompted in my mind the question, how can we, the public, better work with law enforcement when something is unraveling, whether it's a case, whether it's an investigation? How do we better work with law enforcement to avoid things like misinformation?
Well, there's a lot of different things that have to happen, right? So the first thing is the community needs to understand that every time an incident happens, whether you want to report it or not, you should report it because you have no clue whether, in fact, we've had similar situations in town or across town. And sometimes the police needs to address it right away. So I've said this before and I'll say it again. The police is only as powerful in any community. It's only as powerful as the people that support them because we establish those social norms, and then we live by those social norms. And when you break those social norms, that's when the police are there. That's number one. Number two, to give you an example, we had an incident of people were saying there was a shooting going on Reef Road. What it was two kids shooting at apparently another kid with a water gun, with a water type, like a paintball type of filled with water, I guess, I believe it was. And the child and the parents wanted nothing to do with reporting it to the police. And this is a prime example of how when you don't do that, this is when misinformation happens. The other way that misinformation happens is when we don't have an open and honest relationship between, officials, us, and the media. I have always had a great relationship with media. In fact, they still call me for, either advice or for, story ideas once in a while, mm-hmm. or just to clarify things on the police side because they're not really sure of certain things. And you know what? That takes a long time to establish that relationship. But I'm telling you that the media, the media is a powerful force that we need to kind of work with on a daily basis, because we can get a lot of the community policing initiatives done through the media, and they're willing to help. It's just that we have to be open with them and give them the information, because they're not going to, they're relentless. They're not going to stop until you give them something.
True.
So you can't always say it's under investigation, or I have nothing to say, or, you know, because that's taking the wrong approach. So, and it sows mistrust on both entities. The third thing is that between the town and the police department and the community, I'm just a strong believer in everyone working together and getting information out so that we don't have these types of situations, because this is only going to get worse. It's not going to get better. Misinformation is one of the most poisonous things that we can have anywhere, and it's a degradation to all the town services and all the people that are dedicated in the town that actually work hard to make things happen for the community. And unfortunately, it's very simple to break down morale when you start not having communication.
Lieutenant Perez, to go back to the example that you used, the shooting example, which ended up being basically not, it kind of was, but what you were saying. So
yeah, kids playing it,
kids being idiots. So when you look at that example, when you say that not only the kid but also the parents didn't want to report it, is it because people have different perspectives of what is worth reporting? And what I mean by that is, if they are like, oh, it's our neighbors, they're just acting like idiots, we're not going to cause a big thing. You know, do we have the mentality of, like, let's not bother the police?
Well,
like, let's not, you know what I mean?
Mentality. Yeah. What you should have is the mentality that, listen, every citizen, listen, it's simple, right? Town officials are elected, and police officers and fire department, you know, and all and every DPW, every single entity is hired to service the town. We have dedicated our lives in serving the town. You can't serve the town by yourself. It's just impossible. It doesn't it doesn't work. Society will never evolve, and it will never get along if you don't do that. We need the cooperation of the people to actually help support us so that we can serve them. That's how it works. That's how it's always worked. So what happens is, when people start to shut down and they start not having cooperation with the police, listen, the police services has never changed. It's always been the same. The what changes is the relationship the police department, the police officers have with the community, right? So we are always the same. We're always willing to help. We're willing to put our lives on the line to actually save someone's life. We're actually willing to solve problems. We want to do that because that's what we do, and we're very good at it. The problem is that when you don't get the community responding, or, you know, if there's a clash between town hall and the police, or town hall, and I'm just hypothetical, or town hall and the community, or town hall or the community and the police, you start to get a natural breakdown. It's just the way it is. And so one of the things that we can do to combat that is we have to start strengthening ties with the community, strengthening ties between town hall and police, and between town hall. There has to be a trust all the way across the board. Listen, we are all in this together, in this thing called life, right? And we're trying to survive, and everybody's trying to get by. And the last thing that we need is for people, one entity, whether it's the community, whether it's town hall, whether it's the police, whether it's whoever, breaking down and not wanting to work for whatever reason, or maybe not communicating, you know, some type of information. But I'm telling you right now that if we continue down this path, and this is anywhere, anywhere in the country, anywhere in the world, we continue down this path, it's only going to lead to destruction. There's no way that things can work out fine. Everyone needs to come together to the table, be adults, and actually communicate with each other. And so if that means that we have to give a little bit of more information to the media, then it should happen. If town hall needs to know a little bit more, then it should happen. If the police department needs to know a little bit more, then it should happen. The minute we start playing these little shell games where we're in our own little worlds, and I'm not saying that's what's going on, because, you know, I don't see that, but if that's what's happening, that will contribute greatly to the demise of the public trust. And once that starts to happen, you're not going to get any information. I mean, this is nothing compared to what could happen in the future.
Right.
But let me make this clear. Let me make this perfectly clear. The police are only as powerful as the people who empower them to do it. So if you want issues to be resolved, the police are always ready. It's just, what is it that you want? What services do you want, right? You go to a five-star restaurant or a five-star hotel, you expect five-star service. So you tell us what you want, and the only way you can do that is by letting us know every time an incident such as this takes place.
Right, keeping us in the know.
That you,
right.
Yeah, you don't have to give your name if you're simply reporting something. You could always say John Doe, Jane Doe. So I want people to not be misinformed. You don't have to always give us your name, unless you're arrested, of course. But or you're getting some type of infraction or misdemeanor. But other than that, if you're just having contact with police, you don't have, if you don't feel comfortable giving your name, don't give your name. But please report the incident so that we don't get inundated with calls of misinformation, because that's where misinformation starts.
And that,
it
so that you can do
right,
and so that you can do your job. And Lieutenant Jim Perez, I think as simple as this sounds, I think it's a topic that is so worth putting out there. And I appreciate how transparent you are about it. Thank you so much.
No, you're welcome. And here's the other thing. One little thing I want to say. It reminds me of an incident that happened several years ago where Bridgeport actually chased some people, and they came into town, and there was an actual shooting involved where shots were exchanged between police, Bridgeport police, and the citizens. And I remember getting on scene. I was the PIO at the time. I remember getting on scene, and in the corner was News 12, and they were reporting on it, and they had some kid. I don't even know who he was. He looked like it was just a teenage kid that they were talking to. And I remember saying to the captain in Bridgeport, are you going to go over there and address the media? Because if you don't, that's going to be the narrative. The narrative is going to be whatever that 14-year-old is saying. And Bridgeport just didn't – the captain didn't feel comfortable going. He asked me if I would go. So I went over, and I actually gave the actual information of what happened, because, you see, when you don't send an official out to talk to the media, then the narrative becomes whoever they
whoever they can get their hands on.
They can interview the random person that's not even from town. They're from New Hampshire. They're just coming through town.
Right.
And they happen to be there. And now their perspective is what goes on.
That's
the media.
That's the headline.
And then social media starts to light up. Exactly.
Yeah.
So it's very important that we have open and deep communications with the media so that they understand that they can come to you for the truth, because we're going to give them exactly the truth. But if nobody's stepping up to the plate or someone's not willing to meet with them, I'm telling you, it heads for disaster. Every training thing, session I've ever been on my entire career has always stressed that over and over and over again.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know certainly working for the media, I echo that. So if you want to just tell me as much information as you can, I appreciate it. And Lieutenant Perez, you're the best. Thank you for always working with us. For so many years I have worked
you're
with
welcome.
You and I appreciate it. So thank you.
Yeah.
All right, that's Lieutenant Perez here on WICC 600 for Crime on the Mind.